This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. There is no sign of a truce taking hold in Sudan as foreign governments, including the U.S., evacuate their diplomatic staffs. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
Some 70 U.S. Embassy staffers have been airlifted from Sudan's capital, Khartoum, on the order from President Biden, who was advised that there is no end to the fighting between rival military factions. On ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, military analyst Steve Ganyard says the airlift was dangerous, but it appeared to go well.
Three special operations Chinooks flying 800 miles at 100 feet at night on night vision goggles, having to land halfway, get gas, come into Khartoum where there's active combat going on.
But for U.S. civilians, an estimated 16,000, the military said it was too risky to get them out. But the White House vowed to do what it can to help. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Russia claims progress in the battle for Bakhmut in Ukraine. VOA's Joe Ramsey tells us more.
Russia's defense ministry on Sunday said its forces had advanced in Bakhmut, while a top Ukrainian commander posted photographs with his forces saying they were holding the front line that runs through the city, all but destroyed in some of the bloodiest combat of the 14-month war. The Telegram post followed a statement by the Russian ministry. Its troops had secured two blocks in western districts, and airborne units were providing reinforcements to the north and south. Russia sees Bakhmut as a stepping stone to more advances in eastern Ukraine. Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
And you can find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Jordan's foreign ministry says that a Jordanian lawmaker has been arrested by Israel on suspicion of smuggling weapons and gold into the occupied West Bank. The ministry spokesman said Sunday that the Jordanian officials are following the case to find out the merits of the situation and address it as possible. The lawmaker was identified as Imad El-Adwan. Israel's foreign ministry declined comment. The incident threatens to further strain what already are tense relations between Jordan and Israel. Around 3,000 migrants have begun what they call a mass protest procession through southern Mexico to demand the end of detention centers like the one that caught fire last month, killing 40 people. The migrants set out early Sunday near the Guatemalan border. They say their aim is to reach Mexico City, but in the past, many participants have continued on to the U.S. border. The migrants are mainly from Central America, Cuba, Venezuela, Ecuador, and Colombia. One organizer said that they are demanding the dissolution of the country's immigration agency, whose officials have been blamed in a March 27th fire. Police say 39 bodies have been discovered so far in land owned by a pastor in coastal Kenya who was arrested for telling his followers to fast to death. The police official says that more shallow graves were dug up on Sunday and 18 more bodies were found. The dead are believed to be followers of Paul McKenzie. He was arrested last week over links to cultism. 15 emaciated people were found when police raided his property, and four of those later died. Donald Trump defends his push to restrict abortion rights after a rebuke, while other Republican presidential hopefuls tout their commitment before a gathering of influential evangelicals. CP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Trump used a taped speech Saturday at the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition to highlight his actions as president to try to restrict abortion rights, like adding Supreme Court justices that would ultimately reverse Roe v. Wade. Trump's position that abortion restrictions should be left up to the states drew a sharp rebuke Thursday from the Susan B. Anthony pro-life group. His former Vice President Mike Pence used his speech to celebrate Trump's efforts and to take a bit of the credit for himself by calling the SCOTUS appointments the most important of all the accomplishments of the administration. Pence also says he'd support a 15-week national ban, while his advocacy group has pushed for 6 weeks. I'm Julie Walker.
A top election official in Myanmar has been fatally shot in the latest attack attributed to militants opposed to military rule. Military's information office media reports in a statement of responsibility from an urban guerrilla group said the deputy director general of the military-appointed Union Election Commission was shot multiple times in his car Saturday. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
a daring operation to evacuate American diplomats out of Sudan.
Three special operations Chinooks flying 800 miles at 100 feet at night on night vision goggles, having to land halfway, get gas, come into Khartoum where there's active combat going on.
Plus, the conflict in Sudan is pushing the country's healthcare system to the verge of collapse.
The number of hospitals that have been attacked and bombarded has gone up to 13, and there is a total of 19 hospitals that were forced to evacuate. So the situation is very bad.
And extreme weather and global temperatures at an all-time high on Earth Day 2023. Hello there. Today is Monday, April 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Good morning. Good morning, Sunday. The U.S. Agency for International Development sent a team of disaster response experts for Sudan to the region to coordinate a humanitarian response as fighting rocks the country. The eruption of fighting 8 days ago between the army and the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group has triggered a humanitarian crisis, killed hundreds of people, and trapped millions of Sudanese without access to basic services. We hear more from VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias.
The world can't forget the urgent need to broker a ceasefire for the sake of the Sudanese people. Analyst Rebecca Hamilton told VOA via Skype.
What Sudan really needs, what the Sudanese people have been telling us for a long time, is a truly inclusive peace process that is going to be hard and messy and take a long time, but is worth the fight to get to a sustainable democracy.
At the Vatican on Sunday, Pope Francis asked for prayers for the Sudanese people.
I am renewing my appeal that violence cease as soon as possible and that the path of dialogue resumes.
The World Food Program has said in recent days that an impressive number of children are among the refugees fleeing the conflict and that their immediate necessity is drinking water. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
With no sign of a truce taking hold in Sudan, foreign governments, including the United States, are evacuating their diplomatic staffs. Associated Press correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Some 70 U.S. Embassy staffers have been airlifted from Sudan's capital, Khartoum, on the order from President Biden, who was advised that there is no end to the fighting between rival military factions. On ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos, military analyst Steve Ganyard says the airlift was dangerous, but it appeared to go well.
Three special operations Chinooks flying 800 miles at 100 feet at night on night vision goggles, having to land halfway, get gas, come into Khartoum where there's active combat going on.
But for U.S. civilians, an estimated 16,000, the military said it was too risky to get them out. But the White House vowed to do what it can to help. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Sudan's sudden collapse into warfare has dashed plans to restore civilian rule and threatens a wider conflict that could draw in outside powers. And it has also pushed the country's healthcare system to the verge of collapse. Earlier, I had a chance to speak with Dr. Mohamed Issa, Secretary General of Global Health Relief Organization Sudanese Americans Physicians Association in Khartoum. We are hearing hospitals being bombed, evacuated, and even infants being taken out of incubators. Where are you currently speaking to us from?
Currently, I'm in the southern area of Khartoum City. We are about a couple of miles away from Khartoum International Airport, so that's a very hot area. We still continue to hear the exchange of gunfire and the heavy machinery and air fighters, strikes and everything. So the situation continues to be dire. You know, Khartoum has pretty much changed to a ghost town. No one is on the street because we have to leave to get basic supplies to make some food and whatnot. And we see the streets. Lots of bombarded cars have been abandoned. abandoned, and I have seen, you know, dead bodies on the sides of the street, unfortunately. In terms of the medical situation, as of this moment, nearly two-thirds of the major hospitals, which is about 71 to 72%, are completely shut down, which is a 57 hospitals out of 79. Just 2 days ago, four major hospitals has been bombarded, four hospitals. The number of hospitals that have been attacked and bombarded has gone up to 13, and there is a total of 19 hospitals that were forced to evacuate. So the situation is very bad. You know, when you mentioned about babies have been evacuated, the incubators, patients who are on mechanical ventilators, when they lose electricity, they have no gasoline for generators, they do the same. They will start using manual ambu bagging to provide oxygen, and ultimately they'll ask the families to take them to a different hospital or take them home, unfortunately.
What are you doing there as you deal with the situation and your own safety as well?
I'm going to be very honest. I'm exploring all the options to flee the country, you know, for my own safety and the safety of my family as well. And one of the things to mention here that everywhere I go, I make sure that I don't take any ID that would state that I'm a physician. That's a big no-no, because if one of the armed forces, you know, discover that you are a physician, they will take you hostage to treat their injured. And it happened to some of our colleagues and friends here in Sudan. So that's why I have a lot of efforts going on right now to flee the country for my safety. In terms of the medical relief, Sudanese American Physicians Association and Med Global organization, we are basically working to prevent the healthcare system from collapsing completely. So what we have done is we've already opened a hospital in Omdurman city, in a safe zone of Omdurman, that provides obstetrics and child healthcare services. Deliveries, any gynecological problem, you know, taking care of newborn that needs incubators and all of that. All these efforts to offload the hospital and to reduce the pressure from the other hospital so they can treat the injured. The first day we opened the hospital, we received five newborns that have been transferred from a hospital, from other hospitals. They just couldn't find any care there. Four of them survived, one unfortunately died. And one of those five newborns, their family was looking for care for their baby for 3 days. Unfortunately, we may lose the baby, but we're doing everything that we can. So this is one of the examples that we're doing as a medical relief organization. We also opened a healthcare clinic in collaboration with the University of Jazeera, which is in the neighboring state of Khartoum state. For the displaced that left Khartoum state to a Jazeera state, we have seen lots of people that move from Khartoum, or they flee Khartoum to Medan. What's going to happen next is the healthcare system in Medan is going to collapse as well, because it's just simply not equipped to deal with all these people, even with their regular needs. We're providing direct aid to the injured.
You're based in the U.S., but I know you're in Sudan a lot. How long have you been there this time?
I came to Sudan on the April 12th because my father passed away. So I came for the funeral services just 3 days before everything started.
Are you going to continue working, or is it just you have no idea because it's not safe?
It's not safe. It's just I have no idea, to be honest. I'm exploring the options of getting out, but I don't know if it's going to work out or not. I live in a hot area, and I'm not sure if I will be able to get out or not.
Are you afraid?
I am. I am. The truth is, we don't get to sleep at night hearing the sounds of the bullets and the bombs, and we don't get any sleep. We are out of any electricity and water supplies for 9 days now, and that's just going to make everything worse.
I appreciate you taking the time in this very scary situation to tell us and help tell the world what's going on there on the ground, and hope we can reach out again to check on you and see how things are.
Absolutely. Thanks for calling.
That was Dr. Mohamed Issa, Secretary General of the Sudanese American Physicians Association in Khartoum. We're following these other stories from around the world. A top election official in Myanmar has been fatally shot in Yangon in the latest attack, attributed to militants opposed to military rule. The military said the attack was carried out by the People's Defense Force, the underground group coordinating resistance to army rule. 39 bodies have been found so far on land owned by a pastor in coastal Kenya, who was arrested for telling his followers to fast to death. Police say more shallow graves have yet to be dug up. Pastor Paul McKenzie was arrested on April 14th over links to cultism. A 50-member Indian business delegation starts a four-day visit to Russia on Monday as both countries seek to deepen economic ties that have grown in the aftermath of Russia's invasion in Ukraine. In recent months, Moscow has become India's largest supplier of crude oil as sanctions hit Russia seeks more trade with Asian countries. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
That's the sound of the SpaceX Starship's giant array of powerful engines firing up and lifting the monster spacecraft off its SpaceX Starbase launch pad on Thursday, April 20th. It was the first flight test of the fully unified system that included the Starship spacecraft sitting atop the Super Heavy rocket. Reuters said the rocket flew to an altitude of 32 kilometers before, as a SpaceX tweet says, it experienced a rapid unscheduled disassembly before stage separation, or, as I saw it, exploded into a massive fireball. SpaceX chief Elon Musk tweeted, quote, learned a lot for the next test launch in a few months. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. With peak tourism season setting in, Greece is bracing for a record number of arrivals and is welcoming back Chinese tourists. As Anthi Karsava reports from Athens, the warm feelings follow a period of discontent due to the COVID-19 pandemic restrictions placed on travelers from China for the past 3 years, as well as other issues.
On the cobblestone streets of Athens, tavern owner Spiros Bayraktaris opens his arms wide open, welcoming news of what is already being called the Chinese return.
Τους περιμένουμε όλοι με αγάπη, από βάθος καρδιάς η αγάπη μας αληθινή.
He says, we await them with great love from the bottom of our hearts. We want to host them, to feed them, to offer all our services. All restaurants here, he says, are aching for their return. While groups of Chinese travelers are just starting to trickle in, Greece expects the number to surge through the summer, exceeding the roughly 200,000 who visited the country ahead of the COVID-19 pandemic. In recent months, a flurry of meetings between Greek and Chinese officials has helped ease visa restrictions. Direct flights have resumed, but also increased in number and locations in a strategy to boost inflows of travelers from China. Tourism accounts for more than a quarter of Greece's economic earnings, and with forecasts predicting more than 30 million travelers this summer, business and officials here say that the Chinese return will help stoke the engines of this country's lackluster economy after a decade-long recession and the pandemic. Sofia Zacharakis is the deputy tourism minister.
In the past, we see that the average spending from our friends from China was even double than other Europeans who travel to Greece.
Such sweeping feelings of welcome and enthusiasm are new. Just 5 years ago, and ahead of the pandemic, many businesses and locals said they were upset with what they called an oversaturation of Chinese travelers. Greeks pointed to what they say was an over-commercialization of mass Chinese weddings against iconic sunsets on popular islands like Santorini. They also say that on Santorini and other islands, law enforcement, garbage collection, and other services were overstretched due to the influx of mainly Chinese visitors. Concerns were also raised about reckless construction as the host islands sought to accommodate the visitors, and many locals began fearing that Chinese and other visitors were posing threats to social cohesion. Whether such deep-rooted concerns will creep up again remains unclear. For now, though, restaurant menus are being translated into Mandarin, shops are being festooned with Chinese flags, and hotel employees are learning Mandarin. Anthi Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
Reporters from VOA's Azerbaijani service received light shrapnel wounds Saturday while on a reporting assignment in Ukraine. Anna Chernikova brings us their story from Kyiv.
On April 22, 2023, VOA's Azerbaijani correspondent Idrak Jamalbeyli, his cameraman and Ukrainian volunteer were working on a news story from the deoccupied areas in the Mirna village, located in the Kherson region. Russian soldiers occupied the positions they were visiting for more than 6 months.
Я корреспондент Голоса Америки Азербайджан. На момент инцидента освещал последствия российских
оккупаций. A hidden mine detonated as they were walking through these positions, resulting in all three receiving injuries from the flying shrapnel. Jamalbeyli says this was one of the mines left by the Russian soldiers after they withdrew from the area. The mine debris was removed from their bodies after immediate first aid help from the village's residents. The team managed to finish their job in the area, and they are now back in a safe location. Jamalbeyli says this case demonstrates the risks which remain in Ukrainian territories liberated from the Russian occupation after Russia's full-scale invasion over a year ago. It remains extremely dangerous for the local residents to live in these territories, as mines remain a big problem even with the ongoing demining activity. He adds this to the list of atrocities he and his team witnessed in other areas of Ukraine, including the Kyiv region. Such actions create huge risks, first of all, to children and local residents who continue to live in these areas or come back home after evacuation. Anna Chernikova for VOA News, Kyiv, Ukraine.
And for continuous updates on the war in Ukraine, download our daily podcast, Flashpoint Ukraine, from our website. Saturday's Earth Day observance came as climate scientists warn global temperatures could hit all-time highs in 2023 or 2024, and failure to act will lead to dire consequences. With the increasing frequency of extreme weather events and rising global temperatures, it's a pressing concern for many people around the world. VOA's Steve Miller spoke with Jonathan Schultz, Associate Professor of Communications at Cornell University, for perspective on how people's perceptions and attitudes toward climate change have been evolving.
Certainly, climate change has over time just come to, dominate the conversation about environmental issues over time. I went to college. I was an undergrad at Cornell, actually, in the early 2000s. And of course, people talked about environmental issues, but it still seemed at that time like climate change, global warming were sort of far off in the distant future. And, fast forward to 2023, and I just think the world has changed. There's so much more talk about how climate change is all around us, right? We get IPCC reports laying it out in sort of stark detail, the urgency of the issue. I think, even here in the United States, people are recognizing the effects that climate change is having in the places they live and work. I think reporters, I think meteorologists are doing a better job or more often helping people connect the dots between extreme weather events that they see or experience in the news and the role of the climate change is happening in increasing the frequency and severity of those things.
Speaking about connecting the dots and having those conversations about climate change, I remember going back to undergrad, it was all about the environmental movement. And then we had global warming and former Vice President Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth. And now discussions about extreme weather and climate change. And the language has changed over time. Why is that? And is that really important to discussions moving forward?
Right. I mean, language is really something that people are curious about when it comes to an issue as important as climate change. And I think, one of the reasons is that there's this discussion about, didn't we used to call this global warming and now we call it climate change? I've been personally fascinated in that question from a social science perspective and as a person who studies public opinion, in part because if you want to understand how people feel about an issue. You've got to give it a label, right? And sometimes survey questions, for example, would ask people, hey, how concerned are you about global warming? Or they might instead just ask people, you know, how concerned are you about climate change? And of course, these are two, you know, slightly different things. You know, our research has found in the past that these terms did matter. Some work we conducted about 10 years ago, around 2010, found that the American public was more certain that climate change was really happening as compared to global warming. Over time, though, that effect seems to have diminished. We don't find it to the same extent in recent research that we've done. It's as if now the American public gets what you're talking about. You can call it global warming, you can call it climate change. They're familiar with the issue. They know where they stand on the issue.
Is that universal around the world, or is that, you know, more or less an American phenomenon, you know, given what the research has undertaken these past few years?
Right. You know, most of this research was just conducted in the United States. And that's for a lot of different reasons. I mean, the United States was a place where this issue became politicized earlier than it became politicized in other places. But no, this research has been explored in more international contexts, mostly English speaking places, you know, UK, Australia, New Zealand. And at least when it comes to global warming and climate change, there's not huge differences, at least in recent data, in how people react to those two terms.
That was Associate Professor of Communication at Cornell University, Jonathan Schultz, speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Take care, be well, and have a great start to your week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
April 22nd is Earth Day, an opportunity to celebrate nature, reflect on the impact humans have on our environment, and to reaffirm our support for environmental protection. The observance has its roots in the public outrage at the gross environmental degradation perpetrated around the country and the lack of political will to do anything about it. Then U.S. Senator and environmental activist Gaylord Nelson concluded that nothing would be done until enough people made a public show of their outrage. So he organized the first Earth Day on April 22, 1970. It's been an important moment for our country to take stock and to do more to actually conserve the environment, said Monica Medina, Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans and International Environmental and Scientific Affairs.
Earth Day is an important moment for all of us to stop and think about how important the environment is to the quality of life, to our economies, and to our human health. This year's theme is Invest in Our Planet, which couldn't be more important. The United States is working very hard to increase its investments in things like parks and protected areas, water quality, conservation, all sorts of ways that are going to improve the quality of life, changing our energy infrastructure and all of our energy goals to be much more renewable. All of that will lead to many, many benefits for quality of life.
All of that will lead to many, many benefits for quality of life, but also improve jobs and the economy, said Assistant Secretary Medina, who also serves as the Special Envoy for Biodiversity and Water Resources. New protected areas, both on land and in the ocean, are key ways that the government is making progress on conserving our planet and our environment.
We're investing in green infrastructure to make our coastlines and our country much more resilient to climate change and to extreme weather events. And all the money that we're spending in the infrastructure bill to improve our infrastructure in ways that will be much more environmentally beneficial. And we're changing our energy infrastructure in order to be much more dependent on renewable energy that's clean and green.
On Earth Day, let us remember that our environment largely determines the quality of our existence. If we don't have a clean and healthy environment, said Assistant Secretary Medina, we really can't sustain ourselves and live the kind of quality of life that we'd like to have.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.